Technology company sparks controversy in publishing world. It's a common enough headline for the trades, but this time the company is Amazon, not the one you thought of first, perhaps, and the dust-up centers on a popular book fair. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. The Los Angeles Times Festival of Books, coming to the USC campus in mid-April, has independent booksellers burning over a decision to feature buy links to the e-commerce giant rather than through the IndieBound program. Andrew Albanese, senior writer for Publishers Weekly, joins me from New York with the details. And welcome back, as always, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So what set off the very touchy bookstore owners this time?
Yeah, well, you've got that exactly right. Indie booksellers are up in arms this week after the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books unveiled its participating authors on Tuesday. And the booksellers noticed that the list featured buy links to Amazon.com rather than through the IndieBound affiliate program. Now, independent booksellers have long been supporters of this book event, or since it's been in existence anyway. The news sort of had organizers of the festival backpedaling, but you know, it remains to be seen what, if anything, can be done to appease these outraged indies and the authors who perceive Amazon as something of a negative influence in the book publishing world. And now, in their defense, organizers of the fair, which is very popular and very well reviewed, people seem to love this fair, say that, you know, the deal with Amazon was made by the LA Times advertising department, not by them. And apparently, this encompasses more than just, you know, a page of buy buttons on the festival website. Nevertheless, one bookseller noted that the deal demonstrated a complete lack of understanding of the struggles of independent booksellers and the role that Amazon has played in that struggle. Now, in a statement given to PW, LA Times officials said that they are going to be adding to and updating the site with programming and, here's the money quote, additional e-commerce programs. But, you know, it's anybody's guess as to what that means. And so we'll have to stay tuned. You know, readers can follow our coverage of this on the Publishers Weekly website, as always. And I'm pretty sure the story is probably going to have a few more twists and turns before the festival kicks off on April 12th.
Well, this is something that's not going away. And another thing that's not going away, and you know this well enough, is the Apple ebook case, which is seen yet another development this week. What's going on there?
That's right. So this week, we finally got to see Apple's opposition brief against summary judgment in its upcoming damages trial. And, you know, as we reported last week, the pressure is now ramping up to get the damages trial away from Judge Denise Coate. In its brief against summary judgment, Apple attorneys argue that Judge Denise Coate is biased. Now, remember, those damages could be as much as $840 million with trebling. Apple attorneys say that previous statements made by Coate show that the judge cannot serve as an impartial arbiter in deciding whether Apple should pay damages in the state and consumer class actions now before her. And they cite Coates' recent order, among other things, denying Apple a stay of its external monitor. In this case, the judge said that consumers suffered hundreds of millions of dollars in harm. And these unprompted statements, Apple attorneys argue, demonstrate that Judge Coates has already decided what the plaintiffs have to prove in their bid for summary judgment. Now, back to last week, you'll recall that Apple had asked the court to remand the state and consumer class actions back to their original jurisdictions, noting that the court order consolidating the state and federal consumer class actions applied only to pretrial activity. But here's the thing. Summary judgment is pretrial activity, and Judge Coke could conceivably rule on the damages figure without a trial. So that request for a remand does Apple no good here. You know, hence the request for Coke to recuse herself from deciding the summary judgment for bias. You know, and by raising bias, Apple really does two things here. For one, like I said, it ramps up the pressure on her to get, you know, to give up the case and send it back to its original jurisdiction. But the other thing it does is it provides yet more grounds for appeal should they end up losing. Now, should Judge Coate decide to hang on to the case, Apple does go on to argue in its brief, you know, all the various merits of why the summary judgment argument should fail. And I have to say, it does seem unlikely to me that Judge Coate would decide the case at the summary judgment stage, but she very well might. You know, and I know some outlets have said that all of this Apple stuff may not be worth paying attention to until we get to the damages trial. But this is why we are paying attention, because there is a very good chance, actually only be a slight chance, but it certainly is looking more likely that, you know, there might not be a damages trial, that she might just decide to come out and offer a figure for damages and let it go to the appeals court. So the final briefs are expected to be filed today. And next week, we could have some idea of whether Judge Coate will keep the case here in New York or whether I'll be traveling to California and Texas for the trial, if, of course, there is one. So stay tuned on the PW website for those developments next week.
Well, whether you'll be heading for California or Texas remains to be seen, but you are indeed back on the road and headed straight to Indianapolis for the Public Library Association meeting that's coming up next week. And you've got a piece coming into this Monday's issue on the new digital public library venture that we first learned about last year.
That's right. I am on my way to Indianapolis next week, where I'll be, you know, living it up with 9,000 public librarians at my second major library conference of 2014, this one being the Public Library Association meeting. But you're right. As you say, in Monday's issue, our Check It Out columnist, Michael Kelly, has a great piece on the Digital Public Library of America as it approaches its first anniversary of its launch last April. Now, I remember well the discussions about the Digital Public Library back in 2010 when the planning was just beginning, and there were some pretty serious questions about whether such a venture could really succeed. I mean, could libraries really pull together this ambitious digital public library? Well, a year in, the answer seems to be yes. The Digital Public Library of America is in fact thriving, and that's largely thanks to a really innovative structure and a pretty shrewd strategy. Rather than building like a big Library of Congress-like digital warehouse, the DPLA instead is harnessing its network libraries into this singular user-friendly interface. And in its first year, the site has performed very well, with almost a million unique visitors. On the content side, its holdings have tripled. It now has more than 6 million items, and the number of institutions participating has more than doubled. It's now over 1,200. Indeed, the biggest challenge for the Digital Public Library of America, at least going forward, seems to be keeping up with the success. As one DPLA official noted, that's a very good problem to have, but they only have 7 full-time staff members, and they're straining to keep up with all the interests. So you'll definitely want to check out Mike Kelly's column on the DPLA in Monday's issue of PW.
Well, we will look for that, Andrew, and listeners can look for you in Indianapolis next week.
I'll see you there.
And they can always look for you on the podcast for Beyond the Book every Friday. Andrew Albanese, Senior Writer for Publishers Weekly, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, beyondthebook.com. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.